Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The country is closer to health care reform, perhaps than ever before. But Congress still has a huge task ahead. Five different bills on deck. So far, solid GOP rejection and plenty of tensions in the Democratic Party. Former Republican Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said Friday that if he were still there, he'd end up voting yes. Today, we'll ask him why. And former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Howard Dean will join us to look at the road ahead for reform. This hour, On Point, Howard Dean, Bill Frist, and this loaded moment in the health care debate. Bill Frist and Howard Dean will join us in a moment. With me first today from Washington for the latest on health care reform in Congress is Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. Julie, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're so welcome. My pleasure.
So where do we stand, Julie? This is going to come out of Max Baucus's committee finally, what, today, tomorrow?
Oh, probably not until Wednesday. Still
okay.
Waiting for the Congressional Budget Office to come up with a final, I guess it will still be preliminary, total for how much this all costs and whether the amount that's being raised, both in taxes and in cuts to Medicare and other spending, will come up even. So they're waiting to make sure that that all tallies out. We're expecting that number to come up today or tomorrow, and then there'll be a final vote. I would expect probably Wednesday, Thursday at the latest.
Now, we're going to ask you how all these bills end up weaving together. And of course, we know no one knows. But the high points of what's finally come out of the Senate committee, the Finance Committee here, Max Baucus's committee, what are the key points for us to have our eye on, Julie?
Well, you know, the key points of all the bills, interestingly enough, are pretty much the same, which is to say that everyone will be required to have insurance, that there will be these exchanges created. I guess they're all called exchanges except in the Senate help bill, which they're called gateways. But basically, there would be a place for people who buy their own insurance and small businesses to go where they would have a choice of plans. Obviously, the big question that remains is whether among those choices there would be a government-run plan or in the case of the Senate Finance Committee, these member-owned and run co-ops, that there would be some kind of, in all of the bills except the Finance Committee bill, there would be a requirement for employers to help pay for those plans. There would be a lot of help for people with low incomes and somewhat moderate incomes and for small businesses to help pay for those people who are now required to have insurance. There would be some trims in Medicare spending that the people who are making those trims say would not do any harm to Medicare benefits. There would also be some increases in Medicare benefits. Those haven't gotten a lot of attention. There would be some closing of this notorious donut hole in the Medicare drug benefit, where people get paid the first part of their drugs for the year, and then they have to pay all of their drug spending unless they reach this catastrophic threshold, and that's been a cause of much consternation in this Medicare drug benefit, so that would slowly get closed. Those are pretty much the high points of pretty much all of the bills. The Senate Finance Committee bill goes further than any of the other bills, it should be mentioned, in what they call bending the cost curve, in making some changes to the payment systems in Medicare, and it would be hoped that the rest of the private sector would then follow along to change some of the incentives for the way doctors and hospitals and other healthcare providers are paid to try and, you know, dampen some of the overuse and sort of what we call wrong incentives for people to get, you know, better care, more efficient care, and perhaps slow healthcare inflation. Also a notable piece in the finance bill that's not in the other bills is this tax on what they call Cadillac plans, very expensive health plans. payment. This tax would be paid in the finance bill by the insurance companies themselves, but there is, you know, no thought that that wouldn't be immediately passed along to the companies that provide those plans and then to the people who get those plans in the thought that, that there would be a dampening of enthusiasm on providing those Cadillac plans and thus less generous plans would be offered.
Julie, what about penalties then if we're going to have in all these bills, if there's a mandate that everybody have insurance, what about the penalties for not having it? I think I've seen those whacked down repeatedly in some of these bills. What about the Baucus committee bill?
That's right. They did whack down the penalties. One of the last amendments that the Finance Committee passed last week was to lower those penalties. There is a concern, particularly among the insurance companies. Now, the idea of having this individual mandate, the insurance company says this is a quid pro quo. If you don't have a requirement for everyone to have insurance, then people won't buy insurance until they get sick. So they say they can't afford to have no pre-existing condition requirements. They can't sell insurance to all comers unless everybody's required to have insurance. And part of the requirement is that there have to be penalties if you don't buy insurance, because otherwise people will just go without. And they say if the penalties are too light, then people will just pay the penalty rather than buy the insurance. So if the penalty is only $100, then it's a whole lot cheaper to pay the penalty than to buy the insurance. So they're concerned that the penalty will be, if these penalties get to be too small, that people will simply pay the penalty rather than buy the insurance. On the other hand, members of Congress who would like to be reelected are concerned that if these penalties are too big, that people who really legitimately can't afford to buy the insurance will be faced with either having to buy insurance they can't afford or pay penalties that will be really onerous.
We saw this starting at like $1,900 a year for a family, but whacked down to $200
no,
a year
well,
or $800 in one amendment?
Be careful. Whack down to 200 for the first year. And
yes,
this is what happened there in Massachusetts, where for the first year, the penalty was very small. And then the second year, it gave people a chance to get used to the idea. And that's what they did. They lowered the penalty to $200 for the first year. It would get higher the second year. And that's the idea, is to see if how the exchange is working, how the mandate is working, how people are getting used to it. So the idea was to give people a chance to know that there's a requirement and to see, in fact, how this marketplace is working, whether there are insurance products that are worthwhile and that are affordable. Mm. There's a big, big, big concern about affordability.
Right.
About whether there will be insurance out there that people can afford. This is part of this big argument over whether there will be a government-run plan, a public option. Remember, this public option is only going to be available within these insurance exchanges. These exchanges will only be available to people who are buying their own insurance and small businesses. This is not really for everybody.
And that's if it's available at all. What's the schedule, briefly, Julie? How does this go forward? Once it comes out of the Baucus Committee, then you'll have five. What's the schedule they hope for resolving or those five into something for the president?
There's going to be, now it's up to the leaders of the House and Senate to meld these bills together. They'll have to meld the two Senate bills together and take it to the Senate floor. They'll have to meld the three House bills together and take it to the House floor. We're expecting that to happen sometime later this month. Then it's just sort of a waiting game and seeing, you know, what happens. The House is kind of waiting for the Senate. The House hates to have to do something and then, you know, have the Senate kind of sandbag them.
Yep.
So the House is kind of holding back a little bit, I think, waiting for the Senate to go first on this one. But Senator Reid, the majority leader, says he intends to have something on the floor perhaps as soon as next week. I think that's a little bit optimistic. I'm guessing the week after next.
Julie Rovner, you're great. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. My pleasure.
Julie Rovner, NPR's health policy correspondent, joining us from Washington. And now with us from New York, I'm joined by William Bill Frist, former Republican senator from Tennessee, serving 12 years in the Senate from 95 to 07. For the last 4 years, he served as Senate Majority Leader, a trained heart and lung transplant surgeon. His family, father and brother, founded HCA, the largest private hospital operation in America. His new book is A Heart to Serve, The Passion to Bring Health, Hope, and Healing. On Friday, he told Time magazine that when it came to health care reform, he'd take the heat as a Republican and vote for it. Bill Frist, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Tom, it's great to be with you today. Thank you.
Not many Republicans have said that. None sitting on Capitol Hill, as far as we know. You say you'd take the heat and vote for it. I'm not sure what it is, but,
that's right.
But why, sir?
Yeah. You know, Tom, that's the question, is what is the it? And I think Julie just did a great job in terms of outlining where we are today, lot of flux, a lot of change, five different bills, affordability a big issue, impact on the states a big issue, how we're going to finance it. The it that I'm for, I did spell out in the Time interview article that followed the headline. We've got to reform. We've got to have transformational reform that addresses the two big issues that we all know. Number one, bringing the uninsured into the insurance market. Not everybody agrees, but I think overwhelmingly the majority of the American people recognize that there are 20 million hardcore uninsured that need to be brought into the healthcare system. And then number two, which Julie mentioned, that's not getting the attention, that is not in the other four bills. She did mention in the Baucus bill, and that's the affordability, how you bend the cost curve over time. The fact that health care spending to the families listening to us right now, have gone up every year three times faster than wages or the money they're making or the growth of the economy. And people are feeling it now. They can no longer afford the $16,000 and $17,000, which is the average today. It's right about $15,000 today for a family of four. No longer can afford these policies.
But do you think
those two issues have to be addressed.
Do you think Republicans are making a mistake, Bill Frist, and they're solid no to these reform efforts right now? That's what I took away from Karen, our friend Karen Tumulty's interview with you.
I think if I were there, and I'm encouraging my colleagues, including my Democrat friends who I talked to, really, I was there in Washington last week, and so I'm talking to both sides, is to get together and really have a discussion. This thing is not bipartisan. I think when you send signals that you're going to use reconciliation, that you're going to lower the vote to 50 votes for this particular bill, we're in trouble. What we need to do now is have people working together across the aisle. It's an American issue. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue.
Democrat Howard Dean will join us in a few minutes, but we're looking here, Bill Frist. I mean, you've got some great stories in this book. I mean, here you've got operating on then Lieutenant Colonel David Petraeus in 1991 when you were very much in your doctor mode. He was shot through the chest with an M16 at Fort Campbell and you brought him back. I'm sure he's very grateful for that. You also write here that you say Republicans way too often, you write in your book, Senator, cry socialized medicine in response to even reasonable health reform proposals. Has that been going on in this recent season? There's been a lot of shouting about socialized medicine.
Tom, I think the whole debate on the public plan took on this real life of its own, in large part, not so much about the details of what a public plan is or the impact it would have, but on this overall discussion, philosophy of what should the appropriate role of federal government be. And that's why it strikes such a chord. I have one advantage that I write about in the book, A Heart to Serve, and I spend a fair amount of time talking about the year that I spent working as a heart surgeon full-time for the socialized British National Health Service.
Mm-hmm. Way back in your career.
Yeah, it was, but it does color my thinking in terms of what is applicable, because there's a lot we can learn from other countries, like primary care in England and reimbursing it appropriately. But one of the bad things, I think, from America that treasures innovation and creativity and solutions and the sort of great medical miracles that we can create is the denial of care, the waits for care, the rationing for care that come from a truly socialized system. And socialized, and this is where I'm critical of some of the talk show hosts that we have out there today, is socialized care is not what Obama has on the table. Obama doesn't want, I believe he doesn't want, a few of the people in Congress do, but not very many. But a truly socialized system is one that owns the doctors. They own the hospitals. They dictate the prices, all three of those things. And the only, this is ironic, the most socialized system in the world today is not in Europe. But it's right here in the United States at the Veterans Administration system.
But what's
on the table is not socialized medicine. So to say anything that has federal government involved being socialized medicine is just flat out wrong.
Even if there were a public option in it, as proposed in some of these bills, you would say that is not socialized medicine.
Well, it's not socialized medicine because they don't own the hospitals. It's still implemented through the private system. They don't own the doctors, so it's not socialized. But what it is, nationalized, federalized control with directors appointed with all money coming from the federal government. And the reason why the public plan is so unpopular today, as initially fashioned, is that if you have total control made by bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., when healthcare is mainly intimate, local, doctor-patient relationship-driven, you end up being destructive and destroy the innovation, the creativity, the responsiveness, the great things that can be done. And that's the concern. And we won't end up with a federal public plan, I don't think.
And you're saying even if there were, what's proposed here is not socialized medicine. You told, again, our friend Karen Tumulty at Time, you said, I would end up voting for it as leader. I would take heat for it. That's what leadership is about. What about
I also said the IT is bringing 20 million in and not trying to bring 46 million, and the IT are scaled down benefits, possibly starting with catastrophic care instead of promising everybody everything which simply can't be sustained over time. That's the IT, and that's the IT that we need to achieve in working together in a bipartisan way in Congress.
Your family, your father and brother famously started HCA Inc., sold for 20 plus billion a few years ago to private equity, plus another 11 billion. It was the biggest leveraged buyout in history. Huge, huge, huge business. Lots and lots of privately owned hospitals. What about a company like that under the reforms being proposed? Does the mandate, is it actually good business for privately owned hospitals to push all these millions of people into insured status where they would show up with insurance coverage at hospitals?
You know, it's debatable. I think how you pay for this right now, for example, is cutting Medicare about $400 billion. And that's not reform of a system, but that's what's going to probably pass in Congress today. So when you're cutting Medicare, you are cutting care to seniors. You're cutting principally hospitals, and you're cutting doctors. So obviously hospitals and doctors are going to pay a price there because that's going to be a huge cut, and how they deliver care is going to be a cut. On the other hand, doctors and hospitals would benefit from the fact that in Medicaid today, they are not making up their cost in terms of how much it costs to treat a patient. They're not being reimbursed enough. So by having the 10% of people who they see come in with some bit of insurance, I would say maybe catastrophic insurance, but whatever the benefit package is, coming in, they don't have to take that bad debt and pass it off to private insurance, which drives the premiums up. They basically just transfer whatever the bad debt is to the people who are out there paying. But this cost shift is so inefficient and wasteful that when people say that 30% of the healthcare dollar is wasted, a large part of it is in that lack of transparency of not attaching the resources to pay for healthcare to the individual.
Howard Dean is going to join us in just a moment. I want to be sure I understand where you are on the record, Bill Frist, on what is there now. Pick any one of these five bills. Could you say, I would vote for it? You're talking about showing leadership. So are you saying no, some hypothetical thing that is nowhere in town? Or is there something on the table now that you're referring to when you say, I would step up, show leadership, and vote for that?
Well, I spelled it out in the article. I would vote for a plan that has, right now, none of the plans have there. Now, it's getting there. President Obama used to say, I'm going to insure 46 million people. And now in his speech the other night, he said 30 million people. So there's a lot of movement coming on. I would say concentrate on the 20 million people that are hardcore uninsured. And that may be where this bill ends up. In fact, I predicted it probably will end up being that. And bring them in, bend the cost curve. As Julie said, the Senate bill bends the cost curve more than the other four bills. And that means put incentives in there to slow the growth of healthcare cost. But there are 500 amendments out there. Some of them strengthen that bending the cost curve. If that cost curve can be strengthened with amendments in terms of looking, moving towards a value-based instead of a volume-based system, addressing the issues of technology, variation in healthcare, pay for performance, I would vote for the bill. It's not there yet, but that is the best bill that is bipartisan, that is more centrist, that protects the taxpayer compared to the other four bills that are out there.
Let me take one call and go to Howard Dean. Philip in Concord, New Hampshire. Philip, you're on the air with Bill Frist.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that my observation is that the Republicans on Capitol Hill are not looking at the real factors involved here, not looking at the cost increases, double-digit year after year. They're just going forward on a harsh philosophy that any involvement of government of any kind is a non-starter for them. And I think it's a shallow way to move forward. I'm heartened to hear Dr. Frist say that if he was there, he would vote for it.
Philip, we've got it. Bill Frist, are you ready to throw some criticism the way of Republicans. Jim DeMint, South Carolina, you know, talked about just making it Obama's Waterloo. Make him fail. You know, is that the right way?
I'm not going to throw anything at any of my individual former colleagues, but I think it is important not to say no and not to both come to the table, which the Republicans are trying to. I mean, I would criticize the Democrats equally. Yeah, right now, when the Democrats basically say, we're thinking about using reconciliation, we've got 60 votes, we don't have to have you, in terms of really reaching across the aisle and incorporating some of the ideas in and truly negotiating, that's just not going on today. So it's easy to criticize Republicans saying no, but if there is a bad bill that's going to hurt taxpayers out there, that's going to drive up the cost of health care, that's going to overpromise today, that's going to cut seniors, whether it's in Medicare, by $400 billion, there's rooms for improvement, but people need to work together. So I'm not going to criticize Republicans more than Democrats. I do think there's an opportunity to pull people together to address the fundamental issues which Philip mentioned, and it is this cost curve. It is addressing cost, how you slow those costs over time. At the same time, you're promising another 20 to 30 million people care.
Let's bring in Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont, Democratic National Committee chairman until January of this year, former presidential candidate, and of course, physician himself. He's got a new book out as well, Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Health Care Reform. Howard Dean, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Former Senator Bill Frist is with us. He says it's the Democrats coming up the works here, ready to go with their majority without the Republicans. Who's bending? Who's not? What do we need now, Howard Dean?
Well, look, I mean, I'm of course always willing to criticize the Republicans, but in this case, I think we ought to try to focus on what we have in common. I've spent some time with Bill Frist and some time with Howard Baker recently in Tennessee. If we only had people like that back in the United States Senate, I think we would get something done in the middle. But we don't have people like that, or not very many of them. And so we've got all kinds of problems. But to the fundamentals of the issue, without getting into the he said, she said stuff, of whose fault this all is, there is a fair amount of agreement between Senator Frist and myself, and there's also some disagreement. The cutting of $400 billion out of Medicare is not coming out of seniors' hides. That's coming out of insurance companies and medical equipment providers and people like that. For example, I have a 90-year-old mother-in-law. We went to find out what it would cost to get her a wheelchair, which she needed, to go to the medical equipment store on Medicare, which she wouldn't have to pay anything for, but the government would. It was $1,200. If we paid for that out of our own pocket, it was $300. Now, there's an example of what's been getting cut out of Medicare. Mm-hmm. What is getting cut out of Medicare to help pay for this problem is not anything to do with senior care.
And the last time you were with us, Howard Dean, you were saying we've got to have a public option where it's not really reform. There is no public option in the Max Baucus plan. What do you see coming?
That's true, too, and I wouldn't vote for the Max Baucus plan, but I think we've got to get the bill moving along. The reason for the public option is, look, the fact is that the free market doesn't work in health care. If you measure a company, how well a company performs and how productive it is and what its efficiency is, you can usually measure that by profits and margins. In healthcare, if you look at the insurance company, it's perverse. The bigger the profit margin is, the less efficient it is in terms of what it does to the healthcare, because profit can only come from one place, and that's premiums. So for every dime of profit in the insurance business, that's a dime that isn't getting, of your premium dollars, that's not getting spent on healthcare. Now, I'm not in here to kill the for-profit healthcare business, but I do believe we ought to give people a choice. Why can't they choose what people over 65 have or what our veterans have? As Senator Frist pointed out, it's not socialized medicine, but it is government-run. And the truth is, it's far more effective and efficient than private health insurance.
Well, he's pretty critical of what veterans have. Let me get a call from Franklin.
Most veterans think what they have is pretty good. In fact, it's the highest-rated health system of any kind, even including Kaiser, in the country.
I'm not critical of veterans at all. I think it's fantastic. I was basically saying the irony of throwing around this term of socialism, we have to be very careful with. And I use that as an example. But veterans does an outstanding job today.
Oh, so you're happy with that? Well, then, why can't the twain meet then? You know, an awful
lot. I think we can. Yeah. Bill and I have done a bunch of shows, and he is right about a lot of things. He's right about the cost. He probably is right about trying to figure out how to get everybody in all at the same time. I think we can meet some places. It's just too bad the political people can't do it.
Let me get a call from Franklin, Kentucky. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a Catholic priest in a small town in a small church in South Central Kentucky. And part of our church congregation is made up of people also from North Central Tennessee. I figure there's an equal balance of Democrats and Republicans in the church here.
Okay.
And I don't have a criticism, but basically I'm looking for some help because I want to talk at least somewhat or respond at least somewhat intelligently to the people who come to me with their concerns about socialism and abortion and euthanasia being featured in the health care reform bill or bills. And this is actually for all three of you, Tom, Bill, and Howard.
Let's take it first to Bill Frist. Hear it from your backyard, Bill Frist. You told Time, you said clearly the death panels and public plan arguments have been overblown. And, you know, here's Father Robert in Kentucky trying to talk to his congregation about these.
No,
what do you say?
I think that's right. I think it's tough for the American people today because there are not enough thoughtful information getting out to the local communities to really understand what a public plan really is. Public plan is either people jump to socialism or they jump down to the cooperatives without really understanding it. And so we need people like Father, like community leaders and Rotary clubs explaining and re-explaining with good data. Things like the death panels, I think, were way overblown. That came from maybe two or three sentences in a bill that does probably what at least doctors would say needs to be done is if I'm going to sit down and talk to people about these tough issues at end of life, doctor-patient relationship, no prescription, I should be reimbursed for that instead of having to run to the next meeting every 6 meetings. So clearly overblown.
But it was shouted all over the place by your fellow party members as death panels. And here you see the, you know, Catholic priest trying to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and some people feel strong about it. But let's take another issue that Father mentioned. There is taxpayer-funded for abortion in these bills. And is it hidden? Is it direct or indirect? It is an issue worth talking about. We do talk about it politically. It is a policy issue. It's a political issue. It's a moral issue. That, I think, does deserve debate. At least it deserves getting accurate information and airing. And then ultimately, a senator has to vote yes or no. And that is a legitimate issue that I would say deserves even more attention. So, and the public plan we talked about. So that's three examples, some fully overblown, some deserved attention, and some just need better definition as we debate this and hopefully in an increasingly bipartisan way.
Howard Dean, what do you say to our Kentucky priest wrestling with questions of socialism, euthanasia, abortion from his mixed congregation?
Well, I think we've disposed of socialism. This is not socialism. This is what everybody over 65 has, which is Medicare or something like it. It's a public option part of it. Secondly, I think we've disposed of the death panels. Interestingly enough, the original so-called death panel language was written by or supported and put out by Senator Grassley. It was part of a 2003 Medicare revamping bill, and the people in the House who put it in thought it made so much sense that they just stuck it in the public option part of their bill, and it's exactly what Bill Frist just said it was. End of life, you know, seniors are afraid of death like everybody else, but they're even more afraid of going to the hospital and having tubes stuck in every place without their having any say-so about end-of-life issues. This is really another issue where this gives Americans more choice and more control over what happens to them when they get sick than they have today.
And by being able to sit down and talk to their doctor.
Yeah, and let their wishes be known to their doctor and their family ahead of time about what's going to happen if they can't participate in their care at the end of life. It's an important thing, and it's a good thing, and it's too bad it drew so much fire and everybody wilted under the pressure. The abortion stuff, I wouldn't agree yet, although they're going to have to, this is going to be how many angels dance in the head of the pen by the time they all get done with it, that the bill funds abortion. It's very complicated. They're now fiddling around with language that says that only the premium money paid by the patient can fund abortion. I agree with Bill. This is a debate we have to have as a nation. It's a very difficult debate. It comes up around the war issues all the time. Do you want to fund a war?
Howard Dean, we've got to take a break. I apologize there. And Bill Frist, please stand by. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We've got questions for each of you. Dylan in East Adam, Connecticut. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hey, I just want to comment about what you said earlier about mandatory health insurance. I mean, what if you don't want health insurance? I mean, should I be penalized because I don't want health insurance? I mean, what if, I mean, I've always been healthy and I don't see the need for it. I mean, what would that lead to, really? A mandatory swine flu shot? Thank you.
Dylan, we've got it. Let me put it to Republican Bill Frist. Bill Frist, you've said it's time for a mandate. Dylan doesn't want it, so what's the argument you make?
The governor said markets fail, and I would put it a little bit different than how Howard put it. I would say when the government fails by putting so many mandates in healthcare systems today that drives up the cost of healthcare, and markets fail because of lack of transparency. When you go to the doctor, you have no idea what you're buying. You don't know what you're getting. You know what the value is. You don't know what the results will be. And both of those are partially true. It does leave a gap of today 46 million people, and I would reduce that down because of the 46 million people who are uninsured today. 12 million already have a plan out there. It may be Medicaid, it may be a community plan, but there's a plan that's out there that's essentially paid for. And about of the 46 million, 10 million to 11 million people are non-U.S. citizens. And none of the plans address that very well overall. And then you have about 15 million Americans who make more than $60,000 to $70,000 a year. And that may be where Dylan is. That basically, I make money. If I get sick, I'll be able to pay for it. In spite of all that, and there are about 20 million people who simply can't afford health insurance today. So when they go into an emergency room after a motorcycle wreck or with their heart attack, which they will have at some point, or with cancer, which they will have at some point, even though Dylan doesn't feel it now, they come in and that bad debt is passed through the system as bad debt that increases the premiums for everybody else. That's very inefficient. It is wasteful. It's lack of transparency, where if Dylan did have some insurance coming in, that waste would be eliminated. Therefore, I think in this day and time where you have cherry picking, where insurance companies out there have this incentive just to take the patients who will never get sick or the young people like Dylan and exclude others by discriminatory policies, that it is time to, yes, have every American have some sort of affordable insurance package out there today. It's fair. It's equitable. It prevents adverse selection. It prevents the cherry picking that is natural in a public-private system.
And you would make it mandatory.
I would have an individual mandate, and again, I would start not with the richest benefit package in the world, because right now we're in a time of recession and job loss, and people can't afford what most of these Democrat plans right now have. They drive up the cost of health care for everybody by driving up premiums, driving up with excise taxes, with raising taxes very directly by as much as 5% in addition to what you're paying if you make more than $250,000 on as an excise tax. We can't afford promising everybody everything. We can't afford to promise what President Obama promised in his campaign, that I'm going to give 46 million people what I had as a United States senator. We can't afford it today. So an individual mandate could start, for example, with catastrophic care, which means every American would be protected from individual bankruptcy in the event their child develops leukemia, or they develop a cancer, or their spouse has a heart attack.
Which is a very real risk right now. Howard Dean, first, what do you say to our caller? Dylan sounds young, says he's healthy. He doesn't want to be required to have health insurance.
Well, first of all, you do have to have everybody in the system. Otherwise, as Senator Frist points out, it's really not fair. And I'll tell you why. I get this argument all the time when I was governor. We have a helmet law. You ride a motorcycle in Vermont, you got to wear a helmet. They don't have such a thing in New Hampshire. So if you happen to ride in Vermont and you get in a wreck and you have no insurance, we all pick up the tab.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody has to pay for it. If you get in a wreck in New Hampshire, your accident's going to be worse. Unless, of course, you get killed because you didn't have a helmet, in which case it's cheaper. But, you know, the thing is, we all share the risk. It's immoral to turn people away from the emergency room. You can't do it, no matter who they are, and whether they have insurance or not. And so somebody's got to pay for that. If you haven't contributed anything because you have no health insurance, then you're a free rider. Now, there's two ways of doing it. I would vote for a bill with a mandate in it, but I don't personally favor it. What I favor is a hybrid system where everybody under 25 or 30 gets free health insurance. It's dirt cheap. It's basically the Canadian system. If you want it for everybody under 30, there's very low expense for people under 30.
Who pays for it?
The state, the government, just pay for it. Just do it with, I'd use it with a carbon tax, but we don't have to debate that.
Okay.
But you just do it. It's very inexpensive. In fact, in Vermont, we actually have everybody under 18 with health insurance. If you make less than $66,000 a year,
you can insure your kids for $480 a year, everybody under 18. And it worked, and it's very inexpensive. We've never had to raise taxes to do it, although I confess we use Medicaid, which means that the feds put in about 55%. But you do have to get everybody, and I believe that people over 30, you're going to do the responsible thing. I don't think you're going to get a lot of free riders. There's another thing you could do. You could say, okay, we don't have to do a mandate, but you're not going to have insurance. If you and if you don't get the insurance, you're going to have a 6 month or a 12 month period where you don't get the benefit of being able to sign up if you get sick, because that's what happens. People, I don't like Dylan. I'm fine. I'm healthy. Suppose he has a terrible accident. Suppose he gets a terrible disease. It's very unlikely for a young person, but young people do get malignancies. Then you got a $100,000 plan. Well, then the government's not going to cover you.
He's going to want in, but the window would be closed. But we're out of the hypothetical time here, though. Now we've got five nearly when the Max Baucus bill comes through. Five. On the table. How do you see this going forward, Howard Dean?
I think you're going to have an individual mandate, and I think it's going to be watered down. Look, the American people hate being told what to do. It's why I'm so much in favor of the public option. I think they deserve a choice for themselves. I don't think they ought to be told what to do by politicians and bureaucrats and companies.
Do you see the votes in the Senate to get something through here? Can they do it without Olympia Snowe of Maine, the only Republican anybody's talking about?
Yeah, we can't. Look, as the former majority leader knows, the breaking of a filibuster is a procedural vote. You owe that to the majority leader. You know, there's a lot of people who owe a lot of things to Harry Reid, who caucused with the Democrats. I'd expect him to get all 60 votes to break the filibuster. Now, what they do after that is their business.
Should the Democrats compromise further to try and bring over a or more Republican votes?
My reading of the subject is you can't. The Republicans have figured that they're going to try the 1994 strategy they used on Clinton, wreck the health care bill, and hope to bring Obama down that way. Jim DeMint said as much. So
make it his Waterloo.
Yeah, I just don't see how we're going to get there. I think Olympia Snowe is great, and she probably ought to be a Democrat in this day and age, but we're just
Let me jump in a little bit, because the bashing on Republicans, first of all, is not helpful. This 6 years ago, it may not have been quite as partisan as it is today, but it was pretty daggum partisan. You know, we had 10 consecutive judges filibustered on partisan reasons, et cetera. So it was partisan back then as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we passed a bill that ended up probably costing, over a 10-year fully implemented, it'll cost probably $800 billion.
You're talking the prescription drug benefit?
The prescription drug benefit bill.
Which you
and today we're talking about a bill that's going to be, I predict, about $1 trillion. So not quite as big, but it is still big. It involved 40 million people, the people who were in Medicare at the time. And by working together, and it takes the majority to reach out to the minority. You've quoted some of the people who said no to everything. But there are people in the middle. I know them. They're the same people who are at the table right now in terms of the Finance Committee who were able to fashion a bill that was Republican-led, although not especially popular with the mainstream Republicans, on prescription drugs, on health care, equitable access, affordable access to the most powerful tool, that is the prescription drug in medicine today. And we passed it with 76 votes. Equally tough, it involved discussion of a public plan, what happens if the private sector doesn't step up.
But is this all about then partisanship if nobody's stepping up now with this health reform on the table?
Well, I'll go back and say sending signals you're going to use reconciliation or a 50-vote threshold on what is traditionally a 60-vote bill basically says we don't care who you are. And it's not just the Republicans that aren't being listened to. What about the Blue Dog Democrats, the people, the 52 centrists in the House today, who basically none of their proposals have actually made it into the bills? Well, we can talk about it, but most of their proposals in terms of amendments did not make it into the bill. And today you have Democrats, liberal Democrats, running ads on TV against Blue Dogs, against centrist Democrats, because of this fracturing of not working together. There's a spirit now, and it has to be led by the majority, I think, in my mind, to reach across the aisle, to listen to ideas that, yes, may be more market-based, that might not agree with Howard Dean in saying that free markets fail. that do recognize that big government, bureaucratic, led from the top, can destroy innovation and creativity and the next big discoveries out there, and do ultimately, when decided at the top, central control federal government, strip away the individual decision-making that's so important in this intimate doctor-patient relationship where healthcare is delivered today.
Howard Dean, I want to hear you on that. Let me get a call from Bill Frist's Nashville first. Carl, you're on the air in Nashville.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Carl.
Okay, Governor Dean, thank you very much for what you're doing. You keep doing what you're doing. I'm a lone voice in the wilderness. The American people, the American people, we're listening to you. We hear you. The Republican Party, they don't want to do this. They don't want reform. They want vote. They will not vote for anything that's put on the table. And trust me. The Democrats need to have the 60 vote to vote down the filibuster, and then allow the blue dogs and the moderates to vote what they want to do in the bill. I'm telling you, the Republicans do not want this. Their health insurance overlords don't want them to do this. They lie. Keep doing what you're doing.
Carl, we got it. Carl, thanks for calling. Thanks very much. Howard Dean, where is this going? You hear Carl. He says, you go. Do it alone if you need to. Is that how this is going to work out?
I think it probably is going to work out that way. I always agree with Senator Frist when he starts out, but I think the drug bill was a very good piece of legislation, and it has worked very, very well, better, frankly, than most of the Democrats, including me, thought it was going to work out.
He's taken a lot of heat in his own party for that bill over time, though.
Well, yes, but it's turned out nobody's giving him heat now because it worked, and I think everybody, including most of the Democrats, admit that. But let's go on to this big government stuff. That is not what this bill says. First of all, only a relatively small proportion of the people are going to choose a public option. The private sector works fine in a lot of the other parts of healthcare. Innovation is not going to be stifled. There's some very good stuff in there protecting pharmaceutical companies' patents so that they can continue to invest and so forth and so on. Blue dogs have had a significant change in the bill. This bill is a terrific bill for small business because it basically says if you have a payroll less than $500,000 or less than 25 employees, you don't have to be in the health insurance business at all anymore. And that's a huge boost to the small business community, which creates 74% of the new jobs. So, look, we can point the finger at whose fault it is, and I'm sure we're going to spend plenty of time doing that. But the fact is, we got to get a bill. And I'm frankly heartened by what Bill Frist has said, because I do think there's commonality. He has stripped out this debate of things like death panels and things of that sort, which are
socialism, euthanasia.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what he is, this, you know, Bill Frist is somebody who spent a lifetime in the healthcare business delivering care. And he and I have, as I said, been on a lot of different shows together. And there's a commonality between two doctors who practice medicine who actually understand what it's like on the ground, which is not something that most of the folks who are drafting this bill.
But you two aren't going to sit in the Senate or the House on this vote.
I know it's unfortunate. I'm sort of regretting that now.
but what do you think is going to happen? How do you think this is going to play out?
I think there will be a public option. I think there will be a very difficult. The majority leader Reid has a very difficult task right now trying to bring these two bills together. I think the public option will be something along the line of what Chuck Schumer suggested, which does not use Medicare rates, because would be a difficult thing for the medical practices, especially in primary care. I think the insurance companies will continue to do very well, but they will behave themselves better as far as consumers and doctors go.
What do you see coming, Bill Frist? How do you think this is going to unfold?
I think in December, late December, a bill will pass the United States Congress. The bill will have a price tag of $1 trillion, a lot of money. Higher than what's anticipated right now, although the House bill at $1.6 trillion.
Any Republican votes yay in that, the vote, or no?
I think it's too early. It really depends. They still have about 100 amendments just in the one Senate bill, so we still have to put all these bills together. I think it will bring about 25 million people into the insurance market, which is good. There will be significant insurance reform on things like pre-existing illness, which is very good, so you won't have this cherry-picking of people, of healthy people.
Public option in or out?
Everybody's taxes will go up. The increase in Medicaid means that state taxes are going to have to go up. Property taxes are going to have to go up. There'll have to be excise taxes for the $44,000 a person out there or family out there today. They're going to have to go buy a plan, and that's going to cost them an additional $3,000 if they don't have it.
Is that all right by you? Is that appropriate given the need?
The push I would make, which really goes, again, back to what Julie said at the top of the hour, mm-hmm. I would put a big push on changing our reimbursement in health care away from a volume quantity-based system where you just get paid more and more for what you do, and shift it to an outcome quality base based on competition, based on market forces, where people know what they're buying, empower them to make decisions, with what we haven't talked about this hour, a much bigger emphasis than any of these bills put on prevention, on wellness, on employer-sponsored wellness programs and prevention programs.
Watch what you eat. Howard Dean says a public option will be in there. Do you agree?
I think that in all likelihood there'll be a backup public option that will be locally controlled, locally run, locally owned, that will appear only if the private sector is not at the table. If the private sector fails, if there's not a plan for somebody, and the connectors or the exchanges cannot find a plan, that there will, and there almost has to be, a public backup plan. The public backup plan cannot use the monopsonistic purchasing power of the federal government to drive the private sector out of business, or we will destroy innovation in the future.
Well, we'll see. Howard Dean, in a word, is that good enough for you, a trigger for a public option?
Trigger's not good enough to me, but we're awfully close. We ought to keep talking.
Howard Dean, his new book is Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. Thank you very much for being with us, Howard Dean.
Thank you.
And Bill Frist, his new book is A Heart to Serve, The Passion to Bring Health, Hope, and Healing. William, Bill Frist, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.